Okay, today is January 27th, 1986, and I have the pleasure, I'm Bill Schneider, of being here with Eleanor Rydell and Mary Fritz. And this interview was suggested by Mary, who is interested in some of the history of your experiences here on this land, which you've had for a number of years. And so we're going to talk a little bit about what brought you to Alaska and some of the reasons why this land is special to you. So it's a pleasure to be out here. This is a beautiful sight. We've got your dogs here, and we're sitting in this sunny window looking out at the squirrels, and it's truly a beautiful place.
It is a nice place. And as to, should I go ahead and
Sure.
say
Oh,
what?
sure.
Or is that, I've always been interested in Alaska ever since I was about 10, when I got some, I wrote to the Department of Interior for homesteading information on Alaska, and it came back addressed to Mr. Elmer Cunningham. That was me.
This was at the age of 10
It
that
was
you were
about 10,
researching
yeah.
this. Oh.
Well, I wasn't researching. But after World War II, a year or so after, a friend and I drove to Seattle and sold her car there and came up to Alaska, flew up Pan Am.
Where had you been living as a child? Where were you raised?
Near Rochester, New York.
Mm-hmm.
Kinesis is where I was born. And I went to, well, I stayed around Rochester until the beginning of World War II, or the first into the first year when I joined the Women's Air Force, and was in that until the J-Day, and almost came up to Alaska then. I did have a chance to come up as a radio operator. But I was working in a control tower, and it was, I loved it, so I couldn't leave that. That was close, though. So it wasn't until 1947 that I came up.
You'd left the Air Force at that point?
Well, I can't, got out whenever VJ Day was.
And that was it.
That
Well, a little
was
before
it,
me.
yeah. I can't remember the date. That was about perhaps 2 years after the war was over that we came up. And when we arrived, it was June 14th and hot.
This is
Like,
47
this
then.
was 47 when the winters were cold and the summers were hot. And we both had nothing but wool suits because we were coming to Alaska. And oh, it was the rest of our clothes came by boat in September.
But now, had you driven directly to
No,
there?
we drove to Seattle. No,
Mm-hmm.
we didn't drive up the highway, although you could then. But we flew from Seattle to Fairbanks
So you
on
did come to
Pan
the
Am.
hot interior.
We came to the hot interior directly, and there were, let me see, Second Street was paved for a couple of blocks. And I think it was about two blocks on Cushman, and of course the rest was unpaved. And it was dusty and hot. We didn't have a job. We couldn't find a place to stay, and it was just wonderful. It was just like coming home. But we did get a place to stay in a dance studio overnight.
Okay.
Eva McGowan, who was sort of the unofficial hostess for Fairbanks, was the one who found us the place to stay. In fact, she did a marvelous job for all the transients coming in, with the few hotels so crowded, and anyone who had a room that wasn't being used would list it with her. So my friend Rita Perry and I stayed there overnight, and the next morning we thought it was time we found something more permanent. We went out to Ladd Field, which is now Fort Wainwright, and both got jobs. But the best part was that we also got a place to stay for $9 a month at the women's quarters on the base.
So Ladd Field was also military.
base at that time?
Yes.
A different name?
Yes. So yeah, it was Air Force then, mm-hmm. instead of Army. Rita worked in Chena Courts, which were the women's quarters. And she eventually took over charge of Chena Courts. And I got a job as a typist after filling out the application and telling them all the things I thought I could do and listing my typing experience as 10 words a minute. That's what I was hired as. So I kind of learned to type on the job. And of all places, I went to work in intelligence. That was this place. And the first summer was wonderful. Everything was so new and fresh. We rented a car, drove up to Circle Hot Springs. We're looking around for a piece of land that might be open to homestead. There was no Chena Hot Springs Road then. There was simply Steel Creek Road, which came out as Steel Creek does now, down to the place where it turns into Chena Hot Springs Road and then comes by over the creek and I believe only went out a couple of miles past this place at 5 Mile. But the way that I found out about this place was in the fall of the first summer we were there, in the last part of August and the first part of September. On Saturdays, I'd pick potatoes at a potato farm on Steel Creek that was owned by Dr. Fitz. And he and his wife, Dr. Fitz was a missionary, and he and his wife had a lovely place, and for the first time I went out there to pick potatoes, I could see the whole valley and the Alaska Range, and I thought, oh, I have to live someplace where I can see that range all the time. The work was hard, but they had the most wonderful homemade meals. It was better.
Was this supposed to augment your income?
Not really. It was $10 a day. Well, because it was, you know, something I wanted to see what was going on around here. That was the way to do it. No, I didn't like picking potatoes. Nobody liked picking potatoes. But Dr. Fitz did tell me that he thought I might find something out farther out the road.
Eleanor, I'm curious why you were looking for a large piece of land and what your interest was.
Well, I think everybody was. I mean, people were thinking in terms of 160 acres. And also, I had studied agriculture in school, and I thought this would be a wonderful place to start a farm. I never got the farm really started. I got as far as a good pasture area, and that was about it. But
when you say people were thinking of 160 acres, that was the amount that was the homestead, or you
yes.
could get more or less?
No, that was the amount generally under the homestead law that you could get. For that, you would have to clear 20, it turned out to be about 20 acres and live on it for 3 years. But because I had been in the Air Force, I had a veteran's exemption, so that I would only have to put a house on it and live there for a year. Or I don't know if I ever would have gotten the 20 acres cleared in time.
What method did you use to clear your pasture?
Well, when I was homesteading, I never did clear anything except a little bit. I had the put in the road coming up from what was then Steel Creek Road, and had a Wanigan right back up here behind the barn, and I lived there. The first year I got snowed out and I couldn't make it through the first year, so I got an extension, and the next year I did stay there.
Maybe we should back up a little bit and find out how you actually got connected with this parcel of land when you left you picking potatoes and looking for land.
Well, I had an old surplus Army Jeep, a GI Jeep, which had good four-wheel drive, and as long as you added a bit more oil than gas, it kept going pretty well. So I could drive around these roads, and everyone was so friendly here. You know, if you drove out and there was someone there, you'd stop and talk to them. And I did meet Carl Herning, who lives now just across the road from here. He was about my age at the time, not a kid anymore, but he had several younger brothers and sisters that he was raising. And he told me that this, across the road and back in, there was 160 acres along the road was taken, but back in, there was 160 acres that had been taken and relinquished. And I checked it out with the Bureau of Land Management, and it was available, so I filed on it. And that was in 1948 that I filed. And that first year, I didn't meet the requirements. But the next year, the Air Force gave me 3 months' leave to homestead. You can imagine them doing that now. They thought it was marvelous. So they said, take the summer off without pay, and you can come back to work in the winter. So it was a wonderful summer. We put in a road of sorts.
Did you have help with that?
Yeah, I did. I had help from friends. We just cut it in, machetes and axes. And it was that kind of road. not always very drivable.
So that would have been coming in from the west?
It came in, actually, it came in through the lower homestead. Mm-hmm. And it came in from the west and curved around and eventually wound up back just behind this house.
Sounds like a rather lengthy undertaking. It must have been long.
It was. You know, everybody who lived out here was so full of energy, they'd say, Eleanor, you can put that road in a half a day. There's nothing to it. But it took several of us more than half a day and a few good stakes around the fire afterwards to get it in. And then I had a little Wanigan, which had been advertised for sale, which I bought, and we skidded up here and took it off the, placed it down on the ground on logs so that it was no longer movable. Let me see. I think it was 12 by 14. It's just about the right size.
Now, is that the little cabin that's still out there?
Yeah, that's still out there falling down now. Yeah, that's it. And it had...
You brought that in that fall or winter?
I brought it in... No, it was in the winter with snow on the ground. Mm-hmm. I brought it in the winter, that would be of 48 and 49.
And you lived there?
Yes, I lived there.
That winter.
And one of the main problems was keeping the Jeep going. I'd have to get up at 2 in the morning anyway to put another log on the fire because it was a small stove. So then I'd have to go out and start the car. And doing that, and with a kerosene lantern underneath and a big rug over the top, it'd probably start the next morning.
Had you given up your quarters on base? Or?
No, I kept them. And after, when I'd come in from here, I'd stop there and change clothes and go to work. Also get a shower. Mm-hmm. It was nice. So, and I received... trying to think of the papers, I believe, in 1950 on the homestead. And that was such an exciting time to find that I really had some land here in Alaska.
Yeah. Do I understand then that land, large parcels relatively close to town in this area, there weren't that many available then at that time?
Or? Well, there were a good many people who had filed on them. Some had proved up on them and moved back into town. Several were living out here. The homestead below this was homesteaded by Don Herning. that was Carl Herning's brother, and to the east, Joe Kruger had 160 acres. At the time, he also had a big greenhouse, and he would supply the town, and I think perhaps Ladd Field, with fresh things. And let me see who else lived around here.
There was a chicken farmer up that way on the other side, too, right?
Henry Brockman?
Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Henry was up there. Henry and Tilly. There were some other Hernings who may or may not have been living out here at the time. I know Carl had several younger brothers and sisters, and they did eventually homestead quite a bit of land around here, but I don't know where all of them lived. In fact, I very seldom got farther out the road than a mile or two, and I'm not sure if it went much farther. Another old-timer around here who has since died was Carl Lindstrand. He owned the land on both sides of the road near Amanita Road.
Mm-hmm. While you're thinking, we should mention that Jane Williams has joined us. So that's person's voice that we hear.
My husband and I'm Jane Williams, stood at the at the end of Steel Creek Road,
mm-hmm.
and what is now the Chena Hot Springs Road,
mm-hmm.
and we could see the cats working on the Chena Hot Springs Road, and they told us this was a big swale here, you know, where the bullseye is, and this was a hard place to come through, but they said that people were taking up homesteads on either side of Chena Hot Springs Road as fast as they could, you know, get to them.
I believe it. It was surprising how many people wanted homesteads.
Right.
I was thinking what you said about the swale here in the spring when we would try to drive out, that before the bridge across Steel Creek was permafrost, you know, the kind that you could stand on, and it would just wave up and down. You couldn't drive through there. That's jelly, you know.
Were winters different back then, or how in the world could you get in and out a road as long and as primitive as yours through the winter?
Well, I think maybe the winters were different, but I don't think
maybe more snowfall like this year where there's not much.
Yeah, there was more snowfall. There was also something that you would never run across now, which was the fact that people working on the road, the people working for the road commission, would sort of wander up our little road with the blade down as they came up, stop and have a cup of coffee, wander back down with the blade down again, and that would plow the road out.
Nice.
Yeah, it was nice. It was great. And I think they would do that for most anyone who lived out here and was trying to get in and out. Because it was a long walk up from the road.
Otherwise you'd have to leave your Jeep down at Steel
Creek. Leave the Jeep down there, yeah. It was better when I found out about snowshoes, which took me a year.
Okay, so you completed your homesteading requirements in 1950, and I'd be curious just how long you used to access the land in that way, and when the Chena Hot Springs Road start was constructed, and what you did with your land once you were situated there.
I wasn't here when they built Chena Hot Springs Road, because in fact, I was only here a year or two after I proved up on the homestead, because I was married to a man in the Air Force, that's Charles. And, of course, they sent him outside right away.
You had met here.
Yes, we met here. Mm-hmm. So we were outside for a few years, and we came back in time for statehood. We came back the summer that they turned the river gold, only it turned out to be green. Oh, that was wonderful. We had two children then. Lisa, who was, Steve was two and Lisa was seven. So we were really happy they were here for statehood. And Charles had thought he could re-enlist here, his home of record. And we had come up to re-enlist, and they sent him out. I did stay on and out through the winter and the next summer with the kids, and then went outside again.
Were you stationed in a number of different places?
Yes. Mm-hmm. The last place before we came back up here was Wyoming, which we liked very much. But he retired from the Air Force in, 66, and we came up that summer.
Did you all sign the big piece of paper at the end of the bridge there at Statehood Day? Do you remember that?
I don't remember signing that, no. I don't. I know Steve had caught measles coming driving up the highway when we were coming back. And I think Lisa was coming down with them. We had the kids bundled up. They were not really sick, but we were not taking them out too much. But we did bring them out in the car. No, I don't think we signed that.
Dedication.
Yes.
That was a big
thing. Oh, it was. I wish, yeah.
What was done to the river?
Oh, well, they turned the river gold. This was in honor of statehood, and it seemed appropriate that the river should be golden.
By trying to pour in
some chemical.
It got no turned green.
No.
But didn't spoil anything.
No.
Everybody thought it was just part of it.
Eleanor, when you and your family then returned to Alaska, were you able to come directly out to your property, or where did you reside at that point?
We did come out and stay here for a few days, sort of camping out, but we got a house in Arctic Park, and we decided that this was several years before we returned, we had bought an extra 40 acres from our neighbor Joe Kruger, because it would give us better access to the road, and it would also give us the south slope. Otherwise, if we had moved back onto the homestead, we would have had another mile of road to build. As it was, we had a half mile. A mile of road in order to get back onto the higher ground, mm-hmm. which would have been ideal. It's lovely back there. It would have been ideal for building, but it would have been difficult. So we started building right at where the 40 acres joined the 160.
Now you were trying accessing off the Chena Hot
Springs
Road.
Yeah, Chena Hot Springs Road was built.
Yes.
I don't know when that. Do you, Jane?
Not exactly, but around there.
Yeah. Yeah, it was built when we came back. Mm-hmm. That was 67 that we started building. We put the road in and started building.
This house?
This house, and we were having it built.
Yeah, you had to cut the road all the way from the Hot
Springs.
Mm-hmm.
From the Hot Springs, mm-hmm.
And getting easement through, or was it just okay to go ahead and cut roads at that point?
Well, no. No, we had to get an easement from there was nobody else living between us and Chena Hot Springs at that time, so we got an easement from the one owner. That was no problem. And the reason we called this Rifle Road was because Charles took his rifle with a scope on it. It would stand down at the road where there is a survey marker, and line up, and I would walk up the road, and it was kind of a strange feeling to see someone looking at you through the rifle scope. Anyway, he'd tell me, a little to the left, a little to the right, and we did get it in pretty accurately that way.
Yes, you did a nice trick.
So that was in the 67, you cut the road and then started?
Started constructing the house. Of course, the flood came along in 67. We were still living in Arctic Park then. So,
I don't know where Arctic Park was. Was that in the flood?
Oh, it's behind Shoppers Forum, really some distance from the river, but it wasn't far enough. Because that didn't affect building out here at all. But it did affect our builder, who was living closer to the river and whose house got underwater. And by fall, by the time the river had gone down, we had a beautiful long fall, and all through October it was warm and sunny. But everyone had to shovel mud out and redo their houses, and our builder was very busy getting his house back in shape and also helping those who really had a great deal to do before winter came. But we did move in here at the end of October. We had Martsov. I can't remember his first name. His last name was Martsov. We had the two stories and no partitions except some black visqueen here and there. And we had one big electric cord which came up through the basement, up through this floor and all the way up to the second floor. That was our electricity. No heating stove, no cooking stove, but do you remember the big Red Cross heaters that the Red Cross distributed? We had one of those. They were very large and very effective because we had one standing in the middle of the living room here, and it did heat the house pretty well.
Is this an oil heater? Or?
No, not wood. It must have been kerosene or propane. Yeah, I can't remember which.
Mm-hmm.
And
how long did you have to rely on that?
Oh, it was some time, because we did have the house plumbed that fall for the baseboard heat, mm-hmm. and that gave us hot water. I can't remember when we got our electric stove, and I shouldn't forget that.
Well, there was electricity out here then.
There was electricity.
When we started to build.
Yes, yes, we had it put in the summer we were starting to build, so that there was electricity for the builder too. And I can't remember. I think the poles had to come all the way up from Chino Hot Springs Road.
That was expensive.
But not like it is now, thank goodness.
Had phone service then?
No. In fact, it took us 2 years to get a phone, mm-hmm. at least 2 years.
And I assume then the children had to go into town to school. Was there bus service and everything?
Yes, there was bus service, and they would slide down the hill to catch the bus,
mm-hmm.
and I'd slide down the hill to get the mail. Of course, then you had to walk back up. But I'm trying to think. Both kids were in. No, Lisa was in junior high, and Steve was still in grade school when we moved out here. And Steve went to Immaculate Conception, and Lisa went to Monroe. Lisa graduated from the university eventually, although it took her some time. And Steve decided to be a commercial fisherman as soon as he got free of school.
Mm-hmm. Well, I always look at this property as such an ideal place for children, and it's a delightful thing. And I was wondering how you've used your land or enjoyed it.
It is. We had horses. I've always loved horses. We did have horses in Wyoming, which of course we had to sell before we came up. But when we first moved here, there was no pasture land. There was just the broom piles right along where the road is now. We eventually got it cleared a bit more and the pasture established, and I got a horse, and then we got two horses.
Mm-hmm.
And that was nice for the kids.
Mm-hmm.
And the land back, the homestead, we've used so much. That was a place for to ride the horses. It was also a place to pasture the horses. It was a place for kids to tramp around.
Were there trails, or is that something that you sort of, with horses and kids and feet, established?
No, the trail that goes out, the one that you've walked on, that goes north of here, northwest, was put in to help a neighbor who homesteaded was really just beyond our northwest corner, John Blackburn, when I was homesteading here. And in fact, Lynn Funk was the one who put it in, and Lynn lives now across Chena Hot Springs Road on Funk Road. So Lynn bulldozed that for access for John, for Blackie. He walked it. I'm sure it was 5 miles the way the trail went. He walked it back and forth. He could drive up to here and walk. He tried driving, but it generally wasn't successful.
There seems to be a variety of habitat back that way, and I'm sure, what, do you have to dip into the low areas?
Well,
or is that why the road wound along?
Well, that was why, yeah, the first road they tried to put in did go more directly, going west down through the lowland and then up the far side up to Blackie's place. But that was just impassable. Well, it's impassable in the winter because the snow is so deep, and in the spring because it's so wet. There was a month or two in the summer when he could drive that way. But it was better to take the higher ground along the ridge and go through the forested area instead of down in through the lower ground where there are a couple of springs and where the snow melt provides a creek all year round.
Do you have any springs on your property at all?
Yes, just down below there are one or two. They're not, they don't flow prolifically, but they're there, and it's good water. We used to get the water there when I homesteaded out here.
You dig your own well, or you had that dug or drilled?
No, yeah, we had the well here by the house drilled. Yes, and it's been wonderful water. We've never had a problem with it, and there's always been as much as we needed.
How deep is it?
It's 340 feet, mm-hmm. and I'd hate to put one in that deep now.
Yes.
But we apparently got down to a good aquifer, and so we've been able to irrigate the pasture, and we used to have a big garden out here.
That much?
Uh-huh, yeah.
You would irrigate the pasture for just to get better grass?
Or? Yes. I was foolish enough to put in bluegrass. No, I wouldn't do that again. I could have native grass or brome or something. But the bluegrass, as long as it has water, is a wonderful feed for the horses.
Maybe it was your longings to farm.
It was, sort of, yes.
What sort of wildlife would you see in the 160 acres?
And there have always been moose, a good many moose, because there's good habitat for them back there. And we always had a black bear and her family who lived down around the spring, down in through that area. I'm afraid that she's gone. I haven't seen bear tracks or bear sign lately, but I know about 3 or 4 years ago, someone shot the female black bear, and she had 3 cubs at the time.
Oh.
Yeah. And I don't think they made it through the winter, probably. Mm-hmm. I'd be happy if another bear would move in there. Lord, they've never bothered us here. Uh-huh. When we first got horses, we thought they might attack the horses, but they never bothered
us. Did you ever find their den?
I never did, no. I found one that I thought must be their den, but it was awfully small. But it was in the middle of winter, and there was steam coming up through the snow under under the root of a big tree, so it might have been theirs. I don't know how big an entrance a black bear needs. But then we've had lynx around here. We used to have wolves back on the ridge. And when the wolves left, we used to have coyotes. We don't seem to have either one of them now.
When did you see those sort of changes? Because I was thinking, wondering if you thought a bear would even fit in here anymore, because I'm sure there's been much growth since mm-hmm. you built the house in 67. So when did the wolves disappear, and when did all the houses appear?
Well, the houses appeared gradually up until the pipeline boom, the growth was gradual. Mm-hmm. And then there was room for a bear. And the wolves might be here. They were sort of driven out. There was the winter in the early 70s, I think it was, when there were so many wolves over in Chena Ridge. Yeah, and they were back here then also. But I haven't heard them since. I very seldom saw a wolf, but you could hear them. And I don't know if I ever saw a coyote right here, but you could hear them also after the wolves left. Now I don't think there's room. I wouldn't be surprised if coyotes were around still. They can always fit into everything, but I'm not so sure about the bears.
What are some of the other changes you've seen?
Oh, it's, well, you know, it is strange. With fewer people, you seem to know personally a good many more people. And as we have more people here, I find that I know fewer and fewer. And of course, there are the changes that everyone has noticed here. I can't blame anyone for wanting to live out here. I certainly did. It's wonderful too. I just hope they can keep enough open space and enough friendly feeling so it won't change too much.
I think, Eleanor, you've certainly taken a major step in trying to preserve some of that open space in your decision to give your original homestead of 160 acres to a conservation-oriented group. And I'm just wondering when that idea started developing in your thought and how you ended up giving this land to Arctic Audubon Society.
Well, when the children were growing up, before they left home, we thought that we would divide it between Steve and Lisa. They both decided that, much as they had enjoyed growing up in Fairbanks, they would like to move farther out into the state. Steve went to Kodiak one summer with friends and fell in love with the ocean. And when he graduated from high school, he went to Cordova, and he started working on a fishing boat, and he thought, this is the life for me. So he's a commercial fisherman there now. He and his family still live in Cordova. And Lisa eventually married and settled near Kenny Lake in the Copper Valley, and they are buying land on the old Edgerton. So there weren't any children who wanted to live here. And we thought, well, we could subdivide it, but you know, that seemed an awful thing to do to that land. We enjoyed using it so much. And we kept noticing how there were fewer and fewer amounts of land that would support a moose, for instance, although they do pretty well in backyards, it seems, sometimes. But I thought if there was someone who would take this land and look after it and see that it won't be subdivided or overrun with snow machines, it'll be kept more or less as it is, but just for people to have a place where they can walk, watch the birds, ski in the winter, whatever, that would make us very happy. And took quite a bit of looking about, but
when did you start that looking process? Do you remember?
It was about 5 years ago, I think. And I did write the Nature Conservancy, which was interested, but I thought that it was more pressing to keep land in the other states where there was so little, and then probably Alaska could take care of itself. But it was hard to make people realize that Fairbanks was growing, mm-hmm. and there was the country was turning into suburbs, and that if something wasn't kept now, that it would be too late.
So, was there a Nature Conservancy established in Alaska, or were you
No, outside. California was the nearest. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so they were pretty busy with their California conservation. I think they do a fine job there, but I was disappointed they weren't interested here, but in the end it worked out very well because I'm very happy that Audubon is interested. And I
had you belonged to the Audubon Society, or did you just get a thought that maybe they would be interested?
No, I had belonged for a little while and went to the meetings at the university. So,
okay.
Well, I was given Dave Klein's name. He was vice president of Audubon in Anchorage then. And I wrote to him about the 160 acres, which I'd like kept as a nature preserve. And he was interested and said Audubon might be interested. And he stopped out at the homestead when he was in Fairbanks. And we walked around. And he was really impressed with it. And he was so helpful. He did really encourage me in thinking that the Audubon would be able to take care of this as a nature preserve.
I think at that point, then, Eleanor, you were discussing a lot with Bud Lenhausen, who was then the president of the local Audubon chapter. Right, and I believe Bud then, through the local chapter, organized a committee to work with you and Charles on actually the transfer of the land and seeing if Audubon would be an appropriate organization. We worked on that for about a year, I think. And what were some of your goals? What did you want to see? What kind of protection did you want for the land or development?
Well, I think what we worked out with Audubon is probably ideal. I'm very happy that they're taking it over. It will protect the land from development in general. Audubon has said no buildings, just nature trails, not paved trails. No motorized access, no hunting, no trapping. Things such as getting children to appreciate nature is going to be one of their big points, and I'm very much in favor of that. And there'll be a chance for everyone to, whatever it is they like to do when they're out in nature, photograph, just notice, sit down under a tree and enjoy, however they would care to take advantage of land that is left in its original state, more or less in its original state. So I'm very pleased that Audubon has accepted the land, and it was transferred in December of
1984. I know one of the local chapter's goals has been to see if we could acquire your present home as the visitor and education center when you folks are ready to move to Kenny Lake area. And as I sit here just watching all the birds coming into the feeders, I'm thinking how ideal it would be. Maybe you could just mention some of the different things, bird populations that you have here.
Oh, yeah, well, of course we have the chickadees and the red poles. And they're sort of the basis of the ones that we can count on for coming all day long. But there are, I think, two families of gray jays that come every morning. They like the suet, and we put out a little bread and a little peanut butter for them. And then we have the hairy woodpeckers and the downy woodpeckers that will come by for suet, and they also like peanut butter. And sometimes we will have others. We had, for 2 or 3 years, we had juncos that would stay through the winter. It was very difficult for them. They were not, I don't know why it was they stayed here. They should have gone south with all the other juncos. But some of them did make it through the winter, although not all. And we have, occasionally, some of the larger ones. We had a shrike here 1 year. I was happy to see him go because he would sit out there and just check on the fat chickadees. I know it made me very unhappy, but I guess he had to eat too.
the owls out here.
Yeah, we have the great horned owls. I heard one hooting the other night. They've already started calling, I guess. Mm-hmm. We have the great horned owls. We have the very small boreal owls. One was in the haystack a couple of years ago after the voles in there. And we have, I think, short-eared owls also, although I haven't seen very many of them. And those are the only owls I know.
Yes. It's a snowy owl.
Well, snowy owl. Yeah, I've never seen one of those around here. And you were asking about...
But the raptors and the ones that prey upon other...
We do have goshawks. In fact, there's an active nest around here most every year. I don't know where it was last summer. I wasn't here. The one they had used previously, I believe, is empty now because we went and looked at it too often, probably. But we have marsh hawks in the summer. And we used to have the sparrow hawks. I haven't seen them lately either. And occasionally an eagle overhead.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
That's a wonderful representation of the raptors. You said something about a pine grosbeak?
Yes, we do have pine grosbeaks. Some years we will have the whole group, a whole flock. This year they're just, pardon me, two males who come regularly.
What about the migrants? Do you get the Bohemian waxwing?
Yes, we do. We do have them. In fact, sometimes we've had as many as 40 and 50 here, and that's that's too many.
What time do they come through?
Don't they stay here all winter?
Well, they may, but they've always come through where I've been in the fall.
In the fall?
Yes, as if they were coming and eating the berries and then going.
There was one winter when we had that enormous flock that would come quite frequently. And they would, yes, they would just
clean out
everything except the deck, which they didn't leave clean. But I haven't seen them at all this winter. We've had golden plovers, for instance, in the spring when they go through. Not too many. I don't think we're on a main flyway here by any means.
The snowbird?
Oh, yes, we have snowbirds. Yes.
They should be coming before too long, just miles away.
Yeah.
You've got the plovers here, that's great.
Oh, that was only one year. There were some out in the pasture. We don't have a great many migrants. Just a few occasionally come through. Of course, we have the geese going overhead and the sandhill cranes going overhead in the spring. But they don't stop here.
You don't have the water.
We don't have the big enough fields here either.
You did say you had the hairy woodpecker
and downy.
And the downy. Mm-hmm.
I've seen the three-toed, but I haven't seen them at the feeders.
Mm-hmm.
One year we had a robin that stayed on until fall.
Oh.
Yeah.
You must have some dead, natural dead trees out there that they like to nest in.
There are a lot of dead trees, and that's one reason we've left them there, they can be used by the birds. And I suppose we might have flying squirrels out there, but I've never seen them. I think we hear them at night sometimes.
They're around.
I haven't seen them ever.
What kind of different vegetative areas do you have in the 160 acres? You mentioned lowlands and highlands.
There's a good deal of it that is second growth, and that's mainly aspen. Apparently there was a fire through here years and years ago. Where on the trees that are untouched, there are birch and spruce, And these are large trees with some sort of park-like areas underneath them because there isn't too much low vegetation. But those are in the lower parts of the hills. On the higher parts of the hills are the aspen and some spruce and occasionally some birch.
Do you have some permafrost areas?
On the north slope, there may be some permafrost, like the slope to the north of the house, or to the west of the house on that slope. Mm-hmm. There's a little permafrost in through there. But most of it is, it's kind of a horseshoe shape, and it opens towards the south, so that it's a circular area enclosing the lower ground where the little creek and the springs are, and the higher ground is well forested, and then it's more open. There are berries down in the lower ground.
Have you ever seen any fox out there?
Oh yes. We've had some. There was one fox. It must have been the first house he'd ever encountered. He was playing in the pasture out there. And he was playing around and just, he checks the berm piles for mice or rabbits or whatever. Apparently had no idea that there were people living in the house, and we were watching him, and after a long time we moved, and when he saw the movement, he was gone. Yeah.
You mentioned about fires. It is, I have read that the farmers down, or the butchers and the people that had stock would circulate them around the stock, around these springs that were up in this area, you know, Columbia Springs. And so they often would burn off an area on purpose so that they would have better pasture and the springs would be there too. So that was done as common practice for 4 or 5 years in the early Fairbanks history.
That may have been what happened, because you can find occasionally an old burned stump so that you know there was a fire, and it's certainly not first growth up through there.
Right.
Well, that's interesting.
Your enjoyment and love of this land is so evident, and I'm just wondering, you must be taking a wonderful step to consider leaving the area.
You know, when I first came here, I thought I'd never leave Fairbanks. But we plan to build close to where our daughter lives, down on the old Edgerton. And yeah, it's going to be a big step, and it's going to be a wrench to leave a lot of this. But I think we'll leave it in good hands. And I do enjoy my grandchildren too.
Yes. I'm sure that has similarly exciting land around where you're going to.
It is. It's right near the Wrangles. It's beautiful. I've enjoyed these mountains all these years. Can't see them right now.
Shall we talk a minute about some of the old timers you remember?
Oh, all right.
Some of the personalities that shaped the land here?
Oh, yes.
How about starting with Reverend Fitz?
Oh, he was marvelous. He and his wife both, and you may know them better than I do, and so I wish you'd add something. They were just such fine people. They had their homestead and their potato fields, and I believe, was he retired? I believe he was retired from missionary work at that time.
Yeah.
And his wife was a marvelous cook. In fact, that was one of the main reasons for picking potatoes, was because you knew you had this good meal at noon. And when Dr. Fitz sold his place to Bert Stemple, Bert, that was the end of my potato picking career, because that was about 2 years later. Bert took us into town for a meal, and it just wasn't the same. And then
Fitz had a daughter. Didn't she stay, or did she? Do you remember a daughter, a redheaded daughter?
I don't know that I do. No, I, you know, my potato picking career was only on a few Saturdays a year.
I remember going out there at Fitz's place, and he had insulated his barn with mattresses that he'd gotten surplus for maybe dime a piece or something, but he had these mattresses all around the barn.
Well, that's a good idea.
He certainly believed in this country.
Yes.
And he could see this as a golden opportunity for anyone that had the stamina to stay with
him. Oh, yes.
Wonderful, wonderful couple.
And that was a wonderful beginning for me, you know, to meet them. I was thinking, too, of Lyndon Funk, the man who did the cat work around here, who's had, this is his third homestead, not that he's homesteaded them all, but originally he was homesteaded on over near where Bryce's are now in that area, and he was burned out. He moved up at the corner of Steel Creek and Chena Hot Springs, and then eventually he moved down about 4.5 mile Chena Hot Springs back in. He lives on Funk Road now. But he and his wife and family have been here ever since. They were here long before I came here. He was well established when I came.
He was a dairy farmer.
A dairy farmer originally before the fire, yeah. And then the Hernings, of course, Don and Carl were the ones that I knew at the time, but now Harold has developed his land over on the ridge overlooking the valley, and he has some beautiful home sites over there. And Joe Kruger, who was our closest neighbor, was just a fine neighbor. He was a bachelor. He lived in his little cabin. And he was very, all these people were so helpful, because when I was up here, I didn't know what I was doing, you know. I didn't know whether to be afraid of the rabbits, even. They were so big. The moose were pretty scary. Joe would come up often for a cup of coffee, and he would give me a hand if I had car trouble or if I was stuck or something. I got stuck often enough. And when we bought the land from him, he was then retiring and moved to Hawaii. And I haven't heard from him since. So, let me see, do you think of any other
Brockmans? Shirley's in the home now.
I heard that she is. And I heard that Henry is out of the hospital and better. So I'm glad to hear that. Mm-hmm. Yes, we did get some eggs from Brockman's. But do you know, well, how far are they? They're perhaps a mile away. That was a long way when I was homesteading.
To walk for eggs.
Yeah, it was. Now it's so close. I remember another homesteader who lived on Steel Creek and taught me to make biscuits. He was another bachelor, and you know, they were good cooks, bachelors. I guess they had to be. You know.
How did he teach you to make biscuits?
Well, you know, going by. We'd just stop in, he'd give us coffee and biscuits, and I'd ask, I wasn't a cook then, and I'd just ask him how to do it, and he said, come by and I'll show you when I've got the biscuits ready.
Have we forgotten anyone else?
Oh, I remember Tilly Brockman one time when we were stuck along the road and we were getting out shoveling, and Tilly came out with a shovel and the snow just flew. I mean, we were out in no time. she was amazing.
She built her own house, I heard. I don't know.
I bet she did. I don't know.
Doped herself with the help of, didn't they adopt a boy?
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay.
This has been wonderful, Eleanor. Myself, I've learned so much, and I think as Audubon develops the usage of the land and others come to enjoy it, we're all going to appreciate it as much as you have, and it's very helpful to have discussed all the different animal life and habitats that are here, as well as how you came to develop the land. And I'm thinking how exciting it will be for you to do the same in your new home and see you build your roads and houses and whatever else needs to be done there. So I thank you for today, and we wish you and Charles the best in your new adventure.
Thank you, Mary and Jane and Bill. Thank you all very much. I've enjoyed doing this tremendously myself.
Good. Thanks.